for the last few years, the United States and China have been engaged in an escalating trade war that has had a significant impact on both economies. Last week, President Trump announced a new breakthrough, but the details are up in the air. And since China has turned to a market-based economy, its massive market has given China's government big influence on corporate decisions across the world, affecting movies, video games, and most recently, pro sports. The Chinese government protested after an NBA general manager tweeted his support of protesters in Hong Kong, leading the NBA to backpedal in order to protect its business dealings in China. With China front and center in economic and sports news, our next guest joins us to tease out the complicated relationship between the United States and China. Edward Friedman is Professor Emeritus of Political Science at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Ed, welcome to Central Time.
My pleasure, Rob.
Well, when we hear China in the news, it's often about trade, sometimes about spats like this one over the NBA, sometimes about Hong Kong. But give us the baseline. What are we dealing with when the United States deals with the government of China?
We're dealing with something we've never dealt with in our entire life. You have a Stalinist kind of repressive government, which is a super economic power, more dynamic than Japan was in its heyday. And we've never met the combination like this before, ever.
There used to be, I don't know if this is still a thing, a political science theory that says, okay, if you've got an authoritarian government and it brings in market reforms, it inevitably leads to loosening up, to democratic protests and the like. That doesn't really seem to be how it has played out in China over the last couple decades.
Absolutely right, Rob. Many, many people believed that what you call the theory, that it was a description of reality. And it isn't a description of Chinese reality. The difference being, just as you said in your introduction, that the Chinese have learned, actually by copying mostly Japan, how they can have a state which is in no way liberal or democratic or pluralist or open, and at the same time run trade policy which is absolutely a victory for them and a loss for most others.
Do you think the United States went wrong in opening up trading relations with China, most significantly, maybe the acceptance of China into the World Trade Organization?
Well, I wish I had a simple answer to that question. I think that, just as you were saying, most people believed that the opening up of trade, making Chinese people travel around the world, having Chinese see the nature of what free and open societies looked like, would create people who wanted to copy those kinds of institutions. And I don't think we can call people names for believing in a theory which, as you correctly said, was very, very widespread. The question really is, at what point should the United States have become aware that that theory really didn't hold for China, that China, uniquely in the world, had found a way to combine both a dynamic economy and a totally repressive state.
How did they do that? How did they split that difference?
Basically, when Japan, which created this kind of what is usually called an East Asian development state or Japanese-style capitalism, whichever term you prefer, when Japan began doing that in the late 19th century, Japan itself was not a democracy. And so it was not an inevitability that one had to go with the other. The Japanese had created these institutions, so they already suited a state which was not democracy. Japan democratizes with the help of the United States after its defeat in World War II. And by the time that Japan does that, the economic way of doing things is really not dependent on what kind of a political system. And so they did democratize, and it worked just as well with a democratic political system, in fact, better than it had worked with a non-democratic political system.
Talking to Ed Friedman from UW-Madison about the U.S. and China, our diplomatic relations and trade relations between the two. Ed, assuming at any juncture that the United States doesn't like what China is doing, there's a fairly long list there, do we as a country have really much leverage over China?
That's a really great question, Rob. So I think the United States is the largest economy in the world. And so, of course, it does have leverage with just about anybody you want to name. On the other hand, China is the second largest economy in the world, and it's the largest trading nation in the world. Therefore, what United States takes on China, while it has an advantage, it's going to suffer too. The only way that you can win in such a struggle with China is to make it an alliance of the other countries which are being hurt by the way China does things, and for all of us to be joining together. And that, sadly, was the one thing that President Trump seemed to be incapable of doing, that he really is someone who believes in America going it alone. And so he really didn't do the basic thing you had to do to win this war, that is to make sure you had your friends and allies cooperating with you.
There was the Trans-Pacific Partnership negotiation that was almost completed. Donald Trump as a candidate ran against it. Bernie Sanders as a candidate ran against it. Hillary Clinton ultimately turned against it, facing public pressure. Would that have been an effective mechanism to do what you were just talking about, to unite an alliance economically against China?
Absolutely. But as you just said, politics in the United States did not permit this. And so when you talk about which policies one should carry out in order to confront China and try to get China to change its ways, they have to be ways which can be sold politically in the United States. And there was an experience of so much trade from allegedly trade deals having gone wrong, whether that's true or not, that there was no politician who was willing to take it on and support the Trans-Pacific Pact, which would have joined all of the Asia-Pacific countries in a bunch of rules that China really, really would not have liked, and would have forced China to change its ways or to lose out versus all of these Asia-Pacific countries.
A lot of companies very interested in a market that's over a billion people. We've seen Hollywood movies try to make sure that they could get in with the China market. We've seen video games banned because they included Tibet as an independent country. Now we have the NBA rapidly backpedaling on a little bit of criticism of China. Is there a seductive force of this billion-plus market that is having this sort of veto power over our decisions here?
Absolutely. So just as you were saying, so China is the largest trading country in the world. Most firms of any size feel that if they're going to make it globally, they have to make it in China. And so they all want to be inside of the China market. It remains a very dynamic economy, and that indeed puts a great deal of leverage inside of Chinese hands. In terms of the NBA, it's actually tried to have it both ways. I think that the commissioner of the NBA tried by the end to stand up for freedom of speech and the general manager of the Houston Rockets being able to say what he said, which was in support of the struggle of the people of Hong Kong against what I would call the Stalinistization of Hong Kong. On the other hand, there's statements inside of China which are being made in Chinese so that most people here can't read them, are very, very much apologizing to the Chinese. And so it's really up to the Chinese government, who's quite able to read both, to make a decision of what they're going to do. And I think it's a case where the United States has a lot more clout than we like to think. I don't think that the Chinese government wants to alienate the United States. I don't think it wants to lose the NBA. We always point out that there's a lot of money being made on the NBA in China by the United States, but there's a lot of money being made by Chinese in China, by the NBA in China. And they are well aware that if for them to get better in basketball, which they want to do, cooperation with the NBA is very important. And third, they're about to host the Winter Olympics. And the last thing they want is to alienate the United States. So the United States wants to respond. And if they're going to turn against the NBA, have the United States turn against the Winter Olympics in China, which would very badly hurt China.
We're talking to Ed Friedman right now, Professor Emeritus of Political Science at UW-Madison. He's with us to talk about the diplomatic relationship between the U.S. and the government of China. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have a question for our guest about China? What stance do the U.S. government take when it comes to human rights issues in China, the protests in Hong Kong? How about trade policy? Call 800-642-1234. And do you have a reaction to this story about the NBA, the sort of back and forth on criticism of China on Hong Kong and the reaction from China and then the NBA? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or tweet us at Central Time WPR. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Right now, we continue our conversation about U.S.-China relations with Ed Friedman, Professor Emeritus of Political Science at UW-Madison. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have a question about the past, present, or future of the relationship between the U.S. and China? What do you think about U.S. trade policy to China? Do you agree with tariffs? What do you want to see come when it come out of trade negotiations with the country? Should the U.S. be raising concerns about civil rights issues, human rights issues in China? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll go to your calls now. Ron is with us in Delafield. Ron, hi.
Hi, how you doing? Mine is kind of an indirect question. That is, does the NBA have any special tax status within the United States? And if so, because of their muffling of their players regarding the China issue, should that status be changed? In other words, I think their actions are encouraging the lack of human rights within China.
Ron, thanks a lot for the call. I don't know about tax policy across the nation. I know there are tax incentives often for stadiums. But Ed, what do you think corporate organizations like the NBA should be doing when it comes to these issues with China?
So this is really a tough question for every major corporation. Increasingly, what they have been doing is they've been playing a game of called China Plus. That is, they don't want to be stuck alone with China. So they are increasingly at least moving some of their production outside of China somewhere else to try to limit the ability of China to have leverage over them and that have some independence in terms of what their policies are going to be. But the fact of the matter is that China has put together a place which is very convenient for doing business. They've invested greatly in transportation, in ports, in information, in lawyers, and that it is much cheaper in many ways to do business in China than its competitors. And so a lot of things which one would hope are not made in China, say a lot of the meds that we take, which I would never trust how the Chinese decide on the purity and quality. They are so inexpensive to be made inside of China and also arrive in time and so on, that it is very hard for firms to say no. And so firms are well aware right now that they have played a game which they are trapped inside of China. And they most of them do not like it any more than the caller does. And if the caller had some great solution for it, I think that the CEOs of many of the best companies in the United States would like to hear from him.
Ron, thanks for the call. Go to Jim in Dubuque now. Jim, hi.
Hi. I think the fact is, there's a bigger picture issue here that we're undergoing a global equalization of living standards, which means places in the world with lower standing of living are going to rise and places with higher standards of living are going to be diminished. And it's inevitable, and it's a fool's errand to try and think that you can change that.
Jim, thanks for the call. What do you think, Ed?
Absolutely on the mark. There is no doubt that what people usually call the global south is increasing, rising as a percentage of wealth. It's not just China. It's India. It's Indonesia. It's even sub-Saharan Africa since 1995 has been rising at an average rate of 5.5% a year. And the advanced countries are moving much, much slower. And the gap between the two is closing. But
since that is a global case, it is not uniquely China. And that means that firms do have alternatives to China. But as the question points out, if you think, as Mr. Trump does, or at least did when he began, that it will lead to a decrease in the American trade deficit, that's incorrect. Because if these firms leave China, they're mostly not coming back to the United States. They're going to one of these other global South countries, which will also be able to provide cheap labor and less environmental standards and so on, and still be able to outcompete the United States. So this rise of the global South, just as the caller wisely pointed out, should continue even if the United States walked away from China.
And just our last few minutes, Ed, if I'm in China, my living standards have been increasing. Does that mean I'm going to be okay in the long run with an extremely repressive government?
So first, China is far more polarized than the United States. And so the inequalities in China are quite extreme. So some people are rising, but not everybody is rising. So if you think you have a problem of anger at the inequality here, I can assure you it's far worse inside of China. And as for the big question, which you just raised, are there things which are more important than just the bottom line? Of course there are. And it's not just going to be human rights. It is going to be territorial independence. This Chinese government is a very territorially ambitious government, and all its neighbors are very worried about its expansionist goals.
Ed, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you, Rob. My pleasure.
Edward Friedman is Professor Emeritus of Political Science at UW-Madison. He joined us to talk about the latest in U.S.-China relations.